I got bad news, everybody. Here's the deal. We are all probably going to have to work a lot harder. And hey, that's not me talking. It's the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 26th of May. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. You know, sometimes economic news is complicated, sometimes less so, sometimes both, actually, as is the case today. There was a report out this morning on worker productivity from a research group called the Conference Board. And on the face of it, worker productivity is pretty basic: widgets produced per hour worked. The catch is that worker productivity in this country has been falling in a not good way, according to the report, and that's where the economic implications get more complicated. Victoria Stilwell is with Bloomberg News. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the fundamental thing of why productivity matters in an economy.
Productivity is crucial for being able to argue as a worker that you should be paid more, right? So if your job is to churn out bicycles and you can put together three bicycles a day, whereas like Joe Schmo over here can only pump out one per day, you definitely have more leverage to say, hey, I should be paid more. So that's why this issue matters so much to workers. When productivity is slow, they have much fewer bargaining chips to use for those wages.
So to this report today out of the Conference Board that productivity is down and in fact, weaker in the United States than in other places around the world. Long term, how big a deal is that?
There's a big debate amongst economists right now as to whether the slowdown in productivity in the U.S. and globally is permanent or not. Pessimists are more inclined to say, hey, look, okay, we have Snapchat, we have Twitter, we have 3D printers. All those stuff are cool. It's all great, but it's nothing compared to electricity, the printing press. Basically, all the good innovations are gone and have been taken. And then there's this other camp that says, no, it's just really hard to see how things like artificial intelligence and 3D printing add to what we do and in and out every day. And even computers took about 20 or 30 years to really start making a difference in people's everyday work lives.
Right. Okay, so step back for a minute then and look at sort of the bigger, more combined picture, if you will. We have had 75 months of job growth in this economy, and yet the economy itself is not growing the way we want it to. How is this related? How is that related to the productivity issue?
You know, they're all sort of interconnected. So one of the reasons productivity is so weak is because in order to handle any sort of influx in demand, companies are just kind of throwing bodies at assembly lines. They aren't really investing in equipment that would make their workers more productive for whatever reason. Maybe they're uncertain about the outlook for the economy. Maybe they don't think the pickup in demand will last. So they're using workers instead. But when growth falls flat, as it did in the first quarter, it was very weak. And yet employment gains were still pretty solid. So that means that we hired all these people and yet they had less to make. And so that really, really hurts the productivity numbers.
There is nothing, obviously, in a $19 trillion economy that can be fixed by the flip of a switch. But is there a fix, or did we just have to gut this one out and see what happens?
You know, I think it's the latter. One of the things that people point to as sort of an explanation for what's going on with productivity is that we're just not very good at measuring it. So that could be an answer, too. Maybe things are getting a lot better. Maybe the smartphone has made us just insanely more productive and we can't really get a hold on that yet. So I absolutely think we're going to have to wait and see what happens.
Victoria Stilwell covers economics for Bloomberg News. We got her in our bureau in Washington. Victoria, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
Oil hit $50 a barrel today, and then it fell because it's oil, yo. Stocks were up, and then they fell because they're stocks. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Lest you'd been under the misapprehension that the presidential primary debate season is over, I would suggest you just haven't been paying attention this cycle. Donald Trump was on the Jimmy Kimmel Show last night, where he was asked about debating Bernie Sanders. Said he'd love to do it. Sure. Today, Sanders appears to have agreed to it. He's going on the Kimmel Show tonight, by the way. But if you step back and really think about it, Trump and Sanders, populists both, although in different ways, do have some things in common. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer what their debate might be like.
So if you missed it last night, Donald Trump said he'd do a debate to benefit charity.
Hey, if he paid a nice sum toward a charity, I would love to do that.
Sanders tweeted back, game on. Would they take the gloves off? Yeah, but think about what they have in common. And I'm not just talking about their, shall we say, unique and sometimes uncooperative hair and the way they both wave their arms and yell. They're yelling about some of the same stuff, says Lee Drutman, a senior fellow at New America.
Both of them speak to a growing share of the American population that is concerned about the wages that they're earning, concerned about the future.
Trump and Sanders are both big defenders of Social Security, and they talk the same tough talk on trade. David Meyer teaches sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine.
They're able to blame trade agreements and a kind of globalization that has undermined earnings, and they both promise to find ways to change this.
And there's the rub. Sanders and Trump may agree on these economic problems, but their solutions are dramatically different. And clearly, they have huge differences over Trump's wall with Mexico, for example. Meyer says those differences could keep Trump and Sanders from stealing each other's supporters. Or would they? Yana Krypnikov teaches political science at Stony Brook University. She says if you frame the issues carefully,
you could get people to ignore the solution while focusing on the way you talk about the problem.
So don't expect the yelling and hand-waving to stop anytime soon. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
We went out on Twitter and Facebook this morning and asked, assuming this political fever dream does eventually come true, what you would like to hear Trump and Sanders talk about. You can read some of what people said and offer your own ideas at marketplace.org. Much was made a couple of days ago about Mr. Trump's new financial arrangement with the Republican National Committee, what's known as a joint fundraising committee. The Democrats have one with Secretary Clinton as well, we should say. Deals between candidates and the national and state parties to raise money jointly. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains how they work and how much we're talking about here.
From a fundraising perspective, these joint setups are great. Frank Donatelli worked for the Republican National Committee in 2008. He coordinated joint fundraising for the McCain campaign.
You can go to large donors and say, look, we're not going to have multiple entities hitting you up for money.
Instead, you can roll together the max donations for the candidate, the party, the convention, and a whole bunch of states all into one big fat check.
Everybody has to make their own judgment whether or not there's too much money in politics and whether donors should be allowed to write such large checks. But that's the law as interpreted by the Supreme Court.
Now, it used to be that each person had a maximum you could donate in an election cycle, regardless of how it was distributed. But in 2014, the Supreme Court said those aggregate limits were unconstitutional. Tara Malloy of the Campaign Legal Center warned back then that lifting those limits would create an easy path around campaign contribution caps.
Sometimes you like to say, I told you so, but here it's a bittersweet thing to have to say.
Malloy says today, just what she predicted is happening.
The aggregate amounts are given to all the different groups and then simply transferred back often to the big party committees, which then use it for the benefit of the headlining presidential candidate.
Now, these committees aren't breaking the law. They are collecting the cash and, in theory, distributing it to the groups involved. Groups that, if they so choose, can spend it on the presidential candidate.
There's a lot of transferring going on.
Michael Malbin is executive director of the Campaign Finance Institute. He says these kinds of transfers aren't new. They happened in 2012, but the lack of an individual donor limit changed the game.
It's not radically different from what happened in 12 in structure, but it's quite a bit different in amounts, in the size of the numbers.
Under the current setup, an individual donor can give $500,000 to a joint fundraising committee, and that could go up, which means, according to Malbin, the money raised from 100,000 or so major donors in previous campaigns, now he estimates that comes from just 200 donors.
200 donors are being as important proportionally as the top 80 or 100,000 only two elections ago.
Oh, and that doesn't even include the money from super PACs, where donors can give as much as they want. So, effectively, there's no limit to how much money you can give to influence a presidential campaign. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There's been another Greek bailout deal this week, about $11 billion to tide Athens over through the summer. With that lifeline, though, comes more austerity for the Greek people. Cosmas Lazaridis and Antoinetta Giantomeli are teachers. They live in Thessaloniki in the north part of the country. Thank you both for coming on the program.
Hi.
Yeah, good to speak to you too.
Let me ask you first of all about this latest debt agreement. When you see and hear the news of these deals, does it even register with you anymore, or are you numb to them?
After all these years, we're quite numb, I would say, yeah. Because it's also the news that they keep saying every day the same stuff and the same stuff, and nothing really changed to good.
I was there last summer. We went to Athens for a week, plus or minus. And the sense that I had after spending 3 or 4 days literally walking the streets and talking to people was that people had basically given up. They said, it's not going to get better in my lifetime. I just hope it's better for my children.
Yeah, this is actually true. And this is also very bad because you see more and more people losing hope. But for the younger ones, it's really troubling me also because you expect from young people to have dreams and look forward for the future, but they see the situation and they know that it's not going to get better really soon.
And you and Antoinetta, who we'll talk to in a minute, you're teachers, right? So what do your kids tell you when you talk about the mess that is the Greek economy?
Exactly. And this is the last few years, you see a totally different change in a different direction in their thought. Like a few years ago, most of the kids wanted to study and be doctors or lawyers or physicists or whatever. Now they just want to study and go abroad. Like they know that they want to offer to their country, but there is no place for them to be here.
Yes. We prepare them to go abroad, to study, to have experiences, and then come back to Greece maybe in 2030 and make something better for our kids and for them.
Hmm. How is your daily life right now? I mean, are you going without things you used to be able to buy? Have the austerity measures hit you in your paycheck? What's happening to you?
Yeah, our family, it's not exactly the standard of Greece because we are two people. We have both jobs.
Yeah.
We can buy milk or food or a good meat, let's say, once per week. But we don't have our own house. We cannot even imagine to have our own house. And of course, if a baby comes, it would be really difficult for us.
Yeah. What do you do for fun then? I mean, how do you relax in the middle of all of this?
How we relax?
How do you relax? What do you do when you're not working and you just want to forget about all the craziness?
We are going out for a beer with friends.
Yeah.
Or we gather in the house and we can talk a lot of political things.
I bet. I bet. Well, Antoinetta, thank you very much for your time.
I thank you, too.
That was Antoinetta Giantomeli and Cosmas Lazaridis. We got them in Thessaloniki, Greece, in their home. We got them on Skype. Coming up,
everybody's in a hurry to go nowhere quick.
Traffic solutions Atlanta style, but first, yeah, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 23 points today, about a 10%, 17,828. The NASDAQ up 6 points, about a 10%, 4901. The S&P 500 down less than a point, flat as can pretty much be. Closed a second day in a row at 2,090. They got your cowboy boots, your work boots, and your motorcycle boots, your outdoor boots and casual boots, your boot care products, too. They are Boot Barn. Boot Barn Holdings fell back 4% today. Genesco, that was fun. Genesco sells footwear both retail and wholesale, including the brands Johnston and Murphy and Lids, up 9% today after first quarter profits beat forecast. Patterson Companies distributes equipment and supplies to dentists, veterinarians, and rehab centers. Its earnings beat forecast. Shares up 5.8% today. I learn something every time I do this segment. Bonds up. The yield on the 10-year Tino down to 1.83%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We learned this week about the unusual financial backstory to Hulk Hogan's sex tape lawsuit against the gossip site Gawker. Hogan was awarded $140 million in a suit that we now know was backed by Silicon Valley billionaire Peter Thiel. This particular case is a little bit of an unusual example, but the profit-making business of litigation financing is very much alive and well. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that one.
Yes, there are investment funds that put their money behind lawsuits. Law professor Stephen Gillers of New York University says litigation finance firms can help a plaintiff fend off a lowball settlement in a long, expensive dispute.
Especially for the personal injury plaintiff, who is truly the David in the courtroom. And the Goliath is often a Fortune 500 company or a major insurance company.
Another kind of litigation financing focuses on commercial entities. That's the specialty of Gerson Keller Capital, a Chicago-based firm with $1.4 billion in assets under management. Investors include public pension funds. Travis Lankner is a managing director.
We generally fund complex commercial litigation, and we're working with companies and law firms in situations where we can make a minimum investment of at least $1 million.
Lankner says a company may tap his firm because it wants to spend its money on its own operations, not on litigation. And his firm only makes its money when a client wins a case or settles. Lankner says Gerson Keller meets a market need. But such firms have sharp critics, among them Brian Quigley with the U.S. Chamber Institute for Legal Reform.
We're really in the wild west of this industry, where there's a lot of money out there that's chasing a lot of cases, and we believe the result of that is going to be, you know, more litigation.
Quigley says litigation finance firms are more interested in the bottom line than in the pursuit of justice. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
The brand new official Republican Party presidential nominee found himself in North Dakota today in the heart of that state's oil boom, which, since the price of crude dropped a year or more ago, really pretty much hasn't been booming. Donald Trump hit all the key political buzzwords today: oil prices, coal, the EPA, energy independence, fracking. But Inside Energy's Lee Patterson reports now from Bismarck, North Dakota, on what the people who actually live and work in that energy economy actually want.
Outside the conference, a table is covered in orange swag.
Grab a couple.
A couple of sunscreens or wristbands from the Laborers International Union of North America, or LIUNA. Pam Link is the director of business development in North Dakota and Minnesota. They work on pipelines and power plants. So it's not surprising that Link feels strongly about keeping fossil fuels in the mix.
We don't want coal to go away. And we listen to what's happening in Wyoming, with hundreds being laid off in the Gillette area.
As of April, the U.S. had lost around 10,000 jobs in coal mining and around 17,000 in oil and gas in just 1 year. Inside the event center, Ron Ness wants relief from federal environmental regulations. He's the president of the North Dakota Petroleum Council.
You're getting bombarded, and it becomes a mental fatigue issue as much as a resource issue, where you're fighting with your own government at a time when you're fighting for survival.
And they are fighting. 2 years ago, there were 191 active drilling rigs in the state. Now, there are just 29. But not everyone in Bismarck is thinking about rig count and coal jobs.
As long as we don't break any of those disorderly conduct laws, and we're...
I met Austin Klein before Trump's speech, readying for his first ever protest.
I'm very excited. This is huge. I can't contain it.
Klein says his message isn't just anti-Trump, but also anti the negative impacts of an energy boom, like increased crime, environmental issues, and dangerous working conditions.
I'm not against oil extraction. I just want it to be done in the right way,
But the next U.S. president won't really have the power to take on every single energy-related issue, like oil prices, says Lynn Helms. He heads up the state's Department of Mineral Resources.
It's a global commodity, and so it's a supply and demand thing. And that's what we have. That's what we're dealing with.
The commodity is global, but the impacts are very local. Revenues in energy states like North Dakota have plummeted, along with the price of oil. In Bismarck, I'm Lee Patterson for Marketplace.
Lee's reporting came to us from Inside Energy. That's a public media collaboration on energy issues. If you've ever driven through downtown Atlanta, first of all, why? Because it's always a mess. And B, my condolences. Traffic in that city consistently ranks among the most congested in the country. But it would be even worse were Georgia not home to one of the best highway emergency response programs around. They're called HEROES. From WABE in Atlanta, just a stone's throw from the always jammed I-85, Tasneem Shama has the story.
It's the middle of morning rush hour traffic in downtown Atlanta. Cars are backed up for miles. HERO driver Andre Todd is on the lookout for accidents. He's been at work since 4 a.m., and already he's cleared three crashes. He's one of about 100 highway emergency response operators who crisscross metro Atlanta, trying to keep the highways clear.
584 TMC on this call I stopped on. It's going to be a 1051.
Times 843.
He's reporting a 1051. That's shorthand for a car stranded on the side of the road. And they're not just changing flat tires. They're a whole nother beast, says Jason Josie, Todd's boss.
We're this first responder agency who's a little bit of fire, a little bit of EMT, a little bit of towing, a little bit of police. And because we're that, we attract people from all of those disciplines.
Todd's a former firefighter.
The 2-41, it's a Burgundy, Mitsubishi, Gallant, and a gray Honda Accord.
There's a two-car crash nearby, but another driver has picked it up. Soon after, Todd finds an abandoned vehicle on the side of the road. He puts a green sticker on the rear window. The brains of the operation are here at the Transportation Management Center. It's a dark room. The lights you see are coming from the computer monitors. People are scanning hundreds of highway cameras in the metro area. And nine enormous TV screens overhead are focused on the busiest roads. Georgia DOT's Drew Belk gives a tour.
Everybody on the floor has a certain district they're looking at or a certain region, and they monitor the cameras to see what's going on. The police and State Patrol, they also stay in contact with us as to let us know what's happening maybe before we see it.
Jason Josie with HERO says this collaboration is why it leads the nation in clearance times.
If there is a commercial accident that most agencies would consider to be a catastrophe, we clear that stuff in less than an hour.
Here's one reason why the program exists.
The International Olympic Committee has awarded the 1996 Olympic Games.
The Olympics were a time to celebrate, but also a massive logistical headache.
There were specific locations that would have a whole lot of traffic with people going to those particular events. So there was a need to have a very detailed traffic plan, a very detailed response plan.
Carlene Barone with Georgia DOT says a whole lot of money was suddenly available. The state built their fancy new transportation management center, installed hundreds of cameras, large digital message boards, and in 1994, they started the HERO program. It was such a success that more than two decades after the Olympics, HERO expanded from just a dozen operators in 1994 to 100 today.
It's paid for by tax dollars. It's a free program. If you're a citizen of the state of Georgia, heck, if you're just passing through the state of Georgia, it's able to help them when they're in need.
And today, there's a real need for HERO.
Everybody's in a hurry to go nowhere quick, and they don't care who they run over to get there.
Todd says he just wishes drivers would all be more careful. In Atlanta, I'm Tasneem Shama for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, a news item, and then I need a favor from y'all. First of all, the news, Charlie Sheen is back in the headlines. He is apparently the latest celebrity to jump on the personalized emoji bandwagon. They are called, hang on now, Sheenojis, which does have a certain ring to it, right? Which gets me to part two. I am totally doing my own line of emojis, because how could I not, right? I'm going to call them Kaimojis, trademark pending, by the way. Send along your best ideas. Hit us up on Facebook. You can get me on Twitter. It's at Kai Rizdahl. We will do something cool. Don't know what yet, but something cool for the best submissions. Come on, Kaimojis, right? Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please, donate today at marketplace.org. All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 23 points today, about a 10%. The NASDAQ up 6 points, 10% there as well. The S&P 500 flat, less than a point. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Come on, Kaimojis, right? It's awesome.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.